Accession number 9433, Reel 7.
Mr. A.J. Smith, Reel 7. You were telling me about the attack on the 18th.
On the 18th, yes. We've got to our position. Our position, we've got it. And then other Royal Fusiliers have gone through us, jumped over our trench, and gone ahead out of sight of us. And then up go a very light, which means, usually, that an SOS signal, rather, SOS, fired out of a rifle. Somebody in every platoon carried one or two. They're just stuck in the rifle, press it, and up it goes. And the lights, three lights, probably two reds and a yellow or something like that. Then the artillery know, and the people at the back, that there's trouble. And within a very short time, to our rear, come rushing up a chap carrying the top part of a machine gun, another one carrying the tripod, others carrying ammunition, and one carrying a petrol tin full of water, because the machine guns were water cooled, and an officer of about between 30 and 40, pretty winded they all were. They'd run like mad with all this heavy stuff. They go through us, over our trench, and on to take up a position to hold up any counterattack. I don't think they were used in the end, but they went on, and they came up in brilliant style. They should have been filmed, really. The officer was puffing and blowing. He was older than the men, but carrying that heavy stuff is terrific. Of course, I kid myself now. I had a son-in-law in Canada. His father was in the machine gun corps and survived the war, and the description and everything else is so like him, but then officers often looked alike. I say, oh, that was probably him. I didn't know anything about all this then, but just a fancy. Anyhow, I was pleased to see that the officer, everybody who were doing their job were coming up to save any loss of trench.
Have you been in much fire during the attack? And now
not a lot of fire, no fire to speak of. Shells are bursting, yes, but you get used to those. What you don't want is machine guns. So the only fire we'd had was the Germans shelling, and if you kept close up to your barrage, they were further back. So you didn't get... Oh, that was part of the reason, I suppose, they gave us for keeping close to the barrage. If you keep close to the barrage, then obviously you're going to survive, possibly, whereas you wouldn't if you were catching the stuff that's falling over the back. And, yes, the barrage. The barrage gets thinner, because as you advance, so the field guns can't do any more range. You have to rely on the medium and then on the very big. So it really gets thinner and thinner, and you begin to feel a bit uncomfortable. But that closed that episode. Now, what did they do with us after that?
When you were in these attacks, and when you got to... Would you get your food up, your rations up?
That was very difficult. You'd settled in, and then the sergeant or whoever's in charge would say, you and you... two perhaps from this section, two from another, until you got a party of about, company, probably 10 or 12 of you, and you then drifted back. That was a lark in the dark and in everything else. It was night, of course, time. You did that at night. You drifted back for quite a long way until you found the quartermaster, your battalion quartermaster, had got some stores and dumped them well back, or it could be a mile or two, and you then were dished out. Some would get two petrol tins of water. The water tasted very petrol-y always, and you had one over the back, one in front, with a rope in between, and then all the rest of the food was in little sandbags. You would get one or two of those to carry, two to get them back in front, which were quite heavy. Then you turned around and tried to find your way back. I know once we were lost, and we really gave up hope and stepped and found a German dugout and rested in it for 2 or 3 hours. It wasn't deserting, but it was a bit odd. But anyway, we were so hopelessly lost until daylight came, and then we did find some other troops, and they told us how to get back to the people with the food. And then you didn't handle this food yourself. That was left with your quartermaster, who then divided it up between the platoons. And he divided it up between the officer servants, and then the platoons. And then you would get possibly a tin of bully beef between the 4 or 5 of you. You might get some pork and beans, which we, being new, liked very much. Not much pork, only a slither of fat, about so big, but lots of beans.
Just an inch or so square.
The meat. The rest was beans, but we, being new to it, loved them and gobbled it down marvellously. We thought that was wonderful. Sometimes you'd be very lucky and get a McConaughey, which fairly often, which had vegetables in. A round tin, and it had some meat, more meat than you before, and plenty of vegetables, mixed vegetables. That was looked upon as a favour, that was good. And on a very special occasion, you might get a larger tin between quite a number, which had come from either New Zealand. It was sort of compressed mutton, or lamb. That was from New Zealand or Australia or something like that. But that was very rare, but that was a marvellous thing. But it was between quite... And there was bread and tea, that's right, and some butter, I suppose, of some sort. I forget that. But there was bread and there was tea. Tea was dished out. Tea and sugar already mixed. In those days, everybody had sugar. That's no reflection on the present lot, but everybody took sugar. So tea and sugar were mixed and came up in smaller bags. And the bread was, say, one loaf between 5, or might be 6 or 7, one round loaf. And we ate it and liked it and didn't grumble about the scarcity of it, because after a real attack, you always got a bit more because there were less to divide between. The food came up. They didn't allow for that. You often got quite a bit of food after an attack, because there were less people to divide it between. And nobody cried over that. It's just... Everything was very natural, really.
Did you get enough food overall?
Enough. A lot of fresh air all the time. We got enough. I suppose it's enough. But anyone, all those people there, could eat more, whatever happened. So... I never felt hungry. You might get very thirsty. Water's scarcity. You get thirsty, but eating, no, we had enough. Yes, we did have enough. And the open air was terribly good, I suppose, really. Always in the open air.
Were you required to wash and shave? Just scarce water.
Wash. There was such a scarcity of water that you didn't wash once in a blue moon, almost. And we only had one bath in 3 months. So that was in a brewery. They had the big round tubs that had been, huge tubs that had been used for the brewing. And they put hot water in those, and 2 or 3 of you shared one. And soap supplied, and clean underclothes, chatty in a day or two. I mean, shirts and pants clean. And you just washed in this glorious... that's about the only bath we had, that's right, and about 3 to a big tub, a huge tub, all colossal, with lots of hot water in it. And they must have given us sponges or something, because we had nothing. Anyhow, that, and then the clean shirt and pants, that was rather good, and socks, clean socks, because the socks had been on probably several weeks, but they were just solid with your feet. And that was quite a wonderful experience.
Did they make you shave while you were...
Well, I was at that stage when I didn't need to shave. But a friend of mine in the group, he did need to shave, and he hadn't got safety razor, and I had, so I lent him that. I had a safety razor. Mind you, we all had cutthroats, but we didn't use them. I saw a regimental sergeant major use a cutthroat, but the safety razors were on then, and I just lent these to this chap. I hope he survived. I don't know, though. Quiet chap. He did need to shave. I didn't.
Did you have much problem with lice or chats, as you call
them? Yes. We were swarmed with them. It was no good. Even the shirts that came up, I'm sure, were full of eggs, I'm sure. No, we had real trouble. The most you could do is, if you had time and you were not in the exact front line, take your tunic off, run down the seams, whatever you have in tunics, and just crackle all the way down with your thumb, or light a match and go up and down. Oh yes, it was amazing, really. We never bothered about it. I mean, that was life. You just chatted. You just had a chatting session. And you just ran your thumbnail up and down, and or used matches to kill them. Very funny, really. Well, funny, I mean, it was part of life. You were in the open here, you were in the dirt all the time. You were undercover in a building about twice, I think. That was one big old house that hadn't been destroyed. I don't remember the other occasion. So, yes, chatting was a big industry, a big pastime. That's right.
While you were in between attacks, so to speak, what sort of a latrine arrangements would be made?
That I often try and think of. I only remember one box, a big box with a hole in the middle, being placed on a bit of a hill. That was stupid. That was carried by battalion headquarters and dumped on the space. But the latrine business, resting, mind you, I don't think we didn't have all that amount of food, and we were so exercised and so in the open air that there wasn't a daily visit question at all. Like, we were just under eating. We were happy, but we weren't eating enough, and we were using up enormous amount of energy all the time. So I don't remember many problems. The worst thing was, if you were in the line, that was pretty terrible, because we were not in organized trenches. We were in trenches taken over and bashed about. If you needed to go to the toilet, you got a short spade and you took your equipment off. You may have had said a prayer, I don't know now. But you then hopped over the parados at the back and dug a little hole. Mind you, you're scared stiff the Germans would attack or something, and you'd be no arms and your trousers down, and so on. That was very awkward. We only had one trench where you went along, that's near Vimy, you went along and left turn there, the trench going on, and lo and behold, there was a nice little toilet there. But that was in trenches that were occupied for months. But we had none of that. We just had to use shovel and hope that things went all right until you got back again. An extraordinary position, but I don't know, you had plenty else to think about, I suppose, but I have decided, thinking it over lots of times, that we were eating reasonably little, although I say we never felt desperately hungry, and drinking little, and doing things all the time, doing something active all the time, so there wasn't any question of trouble.
Did you have much of a problem with rats?
Rats, they were very unpleasant, and we didn't like them. I didn't like them. The old ones were used to it. But the rats were a problem, because when they scuttled along, they would push dirt down, and you could hear that wherever you were. I mean, you could hear this dirt dropping during the night quite a lot. And even if you dug a little hole in the side of the trench or found one, you'd still have these horrors, dropping these bits of dirt, you know, scratching away. Oh yes, they were very unpleasant. But I was more scared at the first week or two of earwigs, because there were lots of earwigs about, and of course we were lying in the ground. Honestly, that was more scary than any shells that might come over. That's silly. But earwigs, there were plenty of that sort of thing, and you were just lying on the ground or in a hole in the side, nice little cubby hole, But that all wore, that wore off, of course, in time. I mean, that was only a few days, and you got over that. That was silly, but the rats only came later when we got right up into the devastated area. And they lived on the bodies, of course, so it was a nasty business. Very nasty business.
But right, so we've just covered some aspects of sort of life in between attacks.
Yes.
After the Nuralu attack, what happened then?
Ah, yes. After the Nuralu attack, that's the 18th of September, we thought, we didn't think, you don't think, we just didn't do any exercise or anything for the next day or two, that's the 18th, 19th, 20th. But on the 20th, we got together and the officers were buzzing about, because the officers weren't with you all the time. They were back in dugouts. They kept coming up once a night, during the night and so on. But anyhow, they were around, and that was obviously a sign of trouble. And, oh yes. I know how we learned of this trouble. We are now old soldiers after these few weeks, and we are in shell holes again. And we look over there, and it's a sort of sloping cross fields, but sort of slope down to where we are, and lo and behold, what do we see? A procession of troops coming, some of our youngsters that have been sick and coming back, and others reinforced. And immediately, wow, these are coming down several hundred yards away, we see them. We know exactly what's going to happen. We're under strength, and here they are coming down. And they're parceled out to us, some that I say we knew. And down they come, and we are joined. We are now again up to reasonable strength, not high strength, only up then to about perhaps 400, which was strong for those days, because there was nothing but fighting from August the 8th onwards with the arm, the whole advance. They were going to finish the war, that was the point. And so we saw this lot, and so we knew we were for it. So the same day, same evening, we moved off.
What sort of reception did you give these reinforcements?
Much the same, I suppose, as the older ones had given us, because it was not a time for rejoicing. Although, there were one or two jokes made, like, what have you come back for? Some were held out. I mean, they'd had some slight injury, which was cured at the field dressing station and all that. We just did, there were jokes, a few, sort of, what have you come back for? You know, you must be mad or something like that. And no, we didn't give, we weren't enthusiastic, we knew there was more trouble. So that was on the 20th of September, and we moved off. We moved off in the direction of Epey, which was a sort of town, almost a town, very small, but like a town, nearly, not quite. And we went along a railway line, staggering along a railway line between the sleepers, which is not easy in the dark, loaded up, and then we heard a few shells came over, and we heard stretcher bearers. The call was, quite seriously, stretcher bearers. And we heard that coming, so we knew some of our people further back up the line, on the railway line, had been hurt. Anyhow, we staggered on forward until we came to more open piece of ground, country, and lo and behold, there were tapes laid out. That was the only time I think we saw it. Long white tapes. Engineers had been up and laid them out. That was our assembly position. So we towed a line, and Neil then, of course, we were for it. Now, Lieutenant Isaacs and Lance Corporal Green were in charge of our platoon. Lance Corporal Green was a chap from East Anglia, a very nice fellow, and I always thought his people had a shop or something, because he had his own shirts and all that sort of thing. Anyhow, he was a very nice fellow, and we had chatted a bit. So, right, we are there. Then open barrage starts. A terrific barrage straight in front of us, and terrific hullabaloo. All daylight, I mean, not daylight, but the light of all this shelling and so on, And I'm sure we sent forward flamethrowers stuff, flame canisters, I'm sure, because it was brilliant. So then we had to get up, and Lieutenant Isaacs had to move us up and forward, and we got forward about 500 or 600 yards, probably no more, and then terrific machine gun fire, cross machine guns from the Germans, and ghastly, and a lot of barbed wire. And now we could see people falling down all the way along, just terrific, collapsing everywhere. And I was here, and Lieutenant Isaacs and Lance Corporal Green, they were just there, and I heard Isaacs say to Green, "Now, in all this din, we'll all be killed tonight." He was, by the way, but we'll all, and so was Green, "We'll all be killed tonight." And we then kept going forward, but everybody was dropping, there were only a few of us left, so there was huge barbed wire. So about five of us, perhaps five or six of us, dropped into a colossal shell hole and decided, well, we couldn't do anything but stop there. We were within sight of, well, the trenches, the German trenches, only what, perhaps 50 yards away, if that, I doubt it. But there's masses of barbed wire in between. So then we're stuck, and the sun came up, and it was a lovely warm day then, too warm. We do nothing but we're just stuck in this place. The sergeant doesn't know what to do anyhow. Nobody knows what to do. You can't get up and go. You can't go back. You can't go forward. So we stay. Now that was a whole long day staying. Here's a tragic bit here, really. For two or three hours, one of the wounded, I'm not sure it wasn't more than one, but one of the wounded was always calling for his mother. You've got to remember, he was only 18, and he was probably as near, well, he was unconscious and terrible pain, but he kept on calling. He didn't call for father, you don't, apparently it's mothers that matter. And that was really bad, but there came a time when it stopped. Whether he died or whether he was wounded, still alive, I don't know. No way of finding out. He was in another shell hole, laid on the open ground, I expect, probably a few yards off. And then, during this long day, one of the chaps, Fraser, he said, "I'm not stopping any longer, I'm going back." So he beautifully worked himself over the back of the whole shell hole, which was huge, and slid his way through. Now, we never knew, I mean, we wondered what happened to him. When I was in the orderly room after the war, nosing through all the correspondence and things, I came across a letter from an officer of a Chinese labor corps which read something like this: "My men discovered the body of private somebody, Fraser, 9th Royal Fusiliers, and so on. We arranged his burial and all the rest of it." Now, that was months afterwards. I found this little note from this officer. But he evidently didn't make it. Now, when night came on, I believe there was a moon. I've meant to test that one day, but I believe there was a moon. But anyhow, we said, "Right, we're going back." So we all got out and ran across the ground as good as we could, and we did get back into our trench, the trench that was occupied by the remainder of the battalion. And this is unbelievable, but it happened. They said, "Right, put your guns down, get your equipment off, go out and bring in the wounded." Wow. So in the army, you do as you're told. That is true, without much murmur. We took our stuff off, put our rifles lent up against the back of this trench, and went out in pairs to bring in the wounded. And we found one. We got him back. He was hanging round our shoulders, and we got him back into the trench. I don't know whether he'd survive or not. He'd been out there all day in the heat. Anyhow, all of them brought somebody back.
Were you under fire at all?
No, that was another amazing thing. I think there was respect on both sides for people bringing wounded not to fire. I feel there must have been, because there we were. Mind you, we had no equipment, no rifles or anything. We're just bringing in wounded. It amazed. I mean, we expected this is it, but you don't say anything. You didn't. You just go and do as you're told. And then there were the only time I saw the RAMC with the badge on their arms showed they were RAMC in there. They were there. They carried them on stretchers from there on. But usually they were well back. Each platoon had its own stretcher bearer, but they'd been killed. So right, we are then relieved that night. One of our own brigade regiments go through us, and we go back into some older trenches where we look at ourselves. Now that night, 10 out of 13 officers were killed or wounded. 270, I think, other ranks were killed or wounded. So we were left to, we made into two companies with one officer each. They did bring up some other officers in a day or two. And we just occupied a short place, a short run of trenches. There were just this handful of us. We only went in about 400 strong. And so losing that lot, and all the officers, well, except three. Oh, Lieutenant Spence was killed and Isaacs was killed, which was very sad as far as I was concerned, because they were good people. An officer's life, I know, was only 10 weeks in France, you could reckon, because they had to be leading, and there you are. And
how did your morale survive this?
Oh, quite all right, really. It's funny that you chat. The whole day had to be spent talking and so on, and within about 10 feet of us was a dead member of the Cambridgeshire regiment. I always remember his lovely Cambridge blue on a patch on the back. They had a patch. All troops had some sort of... We had a spade, I think. Yes, spade. They had... this chap had the blue. And he was a man of 40, I think. He had a cigarette in his mouth, which the rain didn't dislodge. We thought, oh dear... You know, he'd probably got a wife and children and everything. We had nothing. It was no worry to us, but to him, and he was dead. No doubt he'd be picked up later by Chinese or by somebody and buried properly. But he remained there. We were there for 2 or 3 days, that's right. No, we were there for 2 nights only. And then, lo and behold, on the second night, they took us into... the front line up on a slope and in charge of a sergeant, a regular sergeant who we didn't know, he'd been brought up, and there was an attack going on. The Germans were attacking some of our people down below. They captured a few, by the way. So we'd got to make a feint up on this hill, and we had a very good officer, Lieutenant Rayner, came up to deal with us. We crossed a sunken road and got into the German communication trench. He, meanwhile, all honour to him, ran on the top, on the ground. Here we're down here, wandering forward, and he's on the top. And every now and then he carried several bombs with him, Mills bombs. He took the pins out, held them, and threw them ahead of us. So we were stepping over one or two dead Germans as we went along. But he actually, Lieutenant Rayner, he'd already been badly wounded on his face. He went along the top of on the land. We were well hidden, and he went right along till we settled in at another front line trench business. And then he then went back to do some other work. Our machine gun number one started firing down.